So, counsel, for our next case, can please proceed to the table and settle yourselves in. We've made it to the fourth matter on our oral argument calendar today, and the marshal can call the case. And counsel should please take your time settling in, getting your materials organized or a glass of water. I'll just say a few quick remarks. First of all, thank you so much for being here today. We're looking forward to hearing your argument as well as having a conversation with you. A couple of things you probably know because you've been here before. We really appreciate it if you do take the time to have whatever you need so that you can focus on the conversation. So take a few moments and don't feel hurried. Secondly, when you do get to the podium, please know that you can make some adjustments to be more comfortable. So the height of the podium might be out of whack for you. Please, you know, raise it or lower it, whatever works best for you, and do make sure that the microphone is in a comfortable distance from your mouth so that we can hear the conversation. And then the last thing I'll just remind you of is to please identify yourself for the record before you start your remarks, as well as the client that you are here representing. So, counsel for appellant, you know, if you're ready, you can proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Catherine Brown Furness, and I'm practice in Owatonna and represent Joseph Valentine. When I sat down to review these cases, I was amazed at the constitutional findings over the last 30 years that have really resulted in what we have today, looking at the Jarvis hearings and looking at the tearing down of the state schools and moving to this. And I think what's apparent is that Minnesota really values the commitment process as a due process system, and that every effort is to be made to make sure that not only does due process apply, but the trial court is to look at and consider very seriously what the result should be. In this case, there was an initial commitment hearing, and Joseph Valentine did not attend. And then when it's called a review, or it's almost a, if you're going to continue, excuse me. Him in custody, you have to make further findings.
At the end of the 6 months.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's what we're dealing with today. A question of whether Mr. Valentine should have been continued to be committed. Now, it's our assertion that the evidence that was introduced does not provide a factual basis on which the court can make those necessary findings. And most importantly is we have a report from a social worker, which is Exhibit 51, or excuse me, Document 51, which states in it many conclusions that have no historical basis and no reference to documents, no timing, no anything else. Most importantly, she makes a claim that Mr. Valentine has been historically a danger to staff and threatening to harm his parents. And what's really interesting is none of that appears in the petition. The petition was not grounded on any idea that Mr. Valentine had harmed anyone, either his parents or made threats.
6 months earlier.
Yes, Your Honor. And there was no evidence in the interim that this had happened either. We have the medical records that were introduced, plus we have the report of the doctor that does not provide anything. In fact, she says that their records show that there had been no harmful statements by Mr. Valentine during his time there.
Of course, under subdivision 4 of B12, there doesn't need to be a recent attempt or threat in order to have a final commitment.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think it's really interesting to look at that provision and compare it with the initial one where it's kind of like a presumed that this happened plus a recent. And in this one, the language is likely to have happened. And I didn't find anything that addressed that one way or the other, but it seems to me that the legislators are looking at what progress had been made by Mr. Valentine during his commitment. And in this case, when you say something historically happened, not within the purview of the petition and not of a relevance to the petitioner, that they put that in their pleadings, which would have supported the initial commitment.
But I'm looking at the court's findings, his oral findings, and he seemed to give a lot of credit to Dr. Rambo. I think I'm pronouncing that right.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In her discussion, she was your client's treating physician during this 6 months that he was in treatment. And the court really credited what she said.
It's actually 2 months, Your Honor. She came at the tail end of it, so she really didn't have much time with him. And I think that the judge does credit her, and the findings credit her, but the problem is they aren't of that level of sufficiency of evidence. I think this might have happened is not the same as I know this happened. And we who practice law understand the different levels of evidence that's required. And in this case, it's a firm, you know, convincing standard. And when you have the finding of he might not be able to provide for himself, Dr. Rambo, but admitting that he has family help who are there. And going back to the first Supreme Court Donaldson that I cited, they noted that when you have family and friends to help you, that means you shouldn't be caged.
I did read your client's testimony at the hearing, and at one point he stated that, and I'm quoting, "This infringement of fascism clearly opposite not Freudian's fly-by-night wheeling and dealing, but Western ethics and morals fleshed out in the federal code of law in the spirit of Jesus Christ and Socrates and the rest of Christianity and Western philosophy." And there's a lot more. I had a hard time following his thought process.
I think that's true, Your Honor. You know, this was his closing statement, I believe, rather than testimony. He wanted to act as co-counsel. But I think it's also a question when he's talking about using the internet and doing places and research, and he's on the fifth most deadly drug, and he believes, you know, that the system's trying to kill him. So it's like the thoughts are there, but when he starts going, yeah, I think it maybe does. But
what I'm getting at is that the district court judge also not only had the doctor's testimony, but also observed your client.
Yes, I think that's true, but there wasn't shown in Mr. Valentine's discussion or closing or whatever that he was a danger to himself or others. That's the piece that has to be there. You can be mentally ill and be downtown in Minneapolis panhandling and walk away free, and then you can be mentally ill, and if the court can't say you're a danger to yourself or others,
I disagree with that argument. Subdivision 4 of B12 tells us the three things that need to be proven. That is that he continues to be mentally ill. In context, there's some other categories. 2, that involuntary commitment is necessary for the protection of the patient or others. And 3, there's no alternative to involuntary commitment. The word danger in no place appears in subdivision 4.
I agree, Your Honor. I misspoke calling it a danger.
Whether it's necessary for the, you're talking about the second of those three prongs.
Yes.
But dangerous is different than protection.
Well, when you look at most of the cases that have been affirmed through the Court of Appeals process, you have a link of someone doing physical harm in the predecessor years, someone being convicted of something. So they add that to create a level of danger. Mr. Valentine has never been charged, has never had anything as far as this file and anything we know of that shows, and I would suggest if he did, the county would have put it in their petition.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm want to go back to the family question, because I interpret that as being part of the third element of whether they can commit him on a final basis. Was there testimony or anything in the record that that was a reasonable or viable alternative to judicial commitment? I mean, that could, I could easily understand that you could say, look, he's made a certain amount of progress or he's on medications now and we can manage him in our home now. That seems like a thing a parent or a brother or sister or another relative might say. I'll give it a shot now. Do we have anything like that?
That's what his mom has said continually. Dr. Rambo testified that she had had conversations with the mother, no specific time, place, any reliability, and said that the mother wanted him to be continued with a commitment before he came home.
But there wasn't an expression of a present ability or willingness to take him back.
Not in the testimony, Your Honor.
And of course, it was his parents who called the police to have him leave their home originally.
You know, I think that's part of it. Another piece to this is we never had a copy of the pre-trial or pre-hearing analysis by the county, and they did not support this petition.
The county didn't think there should be a petition in the first place.
That's right. And I suggest that those are the people that have known him and know what's going on, and for that reason, they did not want to be the participant. Also realizing, as you said, Judge, they know the family. They know the situation and presumably felt that it was being handled appropriately.
Except it was his parents who took him to the Owatonna Hospital.
Yeah, I think it's almost like a respite, Your Honor, except the question becomes, is that a choice you should make for respite care to go through the system again? The decision was made by the county to proceed with it, but I think others could suggest that maybe at that point there would have been intervention and alternatives.
I'm just not clear of the process. Maybe Owatonna didn't have the psychiatric beds, but he gets transferred up to St. Joe's.
Owatonna has Alina Hospital, and the Alina Hospital has a mental health unit. The Mayo Clinic runs the clinic part of it, so it's a little bit confusing. But I'm not aware of why he was not hospitalized that day at the mental health unit. I presume it was something either his treating physician wouldn't agree to it or there wasn't room, most likely the latter. So that makes sense, Judge. Yeah, I don't want to say we're a small town, but in relative, we still are, kind of. Looking at the other piece that there weren't findings on is there were no findings or made suggestions on alternatives. As you mentioned, Judge Rodenberg, the idea that he could go home, the idea that his family was there, and there was no testimony from, say, his treating ongoing worker, social worker, as to what should be done.
The only thing I saw by way of findings was under conclusions of law about that there is no reasonable available alternative. That's all I see.
That's correct, Your Honor, and we think
under subdivision 7, the district court is obligated to say what less restrictive alternatives have been considered, whether they were rejected, and if they were rejected, why?
I think that's true, and Your Honor, for that basis, there's a remand for additional findings, except there weren't any findings in there that you could grasp to say anything about the reasonable alternatives. The court seemed to write in his memo, though, that he thought it was the Joseph Valentine's obligation to put forth the alternatives, which is true in the sexual predator kind of statute, but it is not true in the review and commitment, citing the phrases of the statute that you just said, Your Honor.
Well, what if there's no evidence at all? That's kind of where I end up. What if there's no evidence at all, regardless of who was supposed to produce it or what had that burden, that the district court just doesn't have any, isn't presented with any alternatives other than go home? What's the district court supposed to do?
Probably depends on how small your town is and how well council knows each other, where the judge...
I'm in the district court in a small town.
I know you did, Your Honor. You know, whether the judge might just say to council, you just don't have that piece. I'm going to give you 5 days to fill it in, or I'm going to throw it out. You know, those are possibilities, or just straight up rule, you didn't say anything that I can make on this, so I'm going to deny it.
Well, the judge does say in the oral finding, sounds like you do have some family that supports you. I think that's a wonderful thing. But they're not in full support of you now, just given your situation, also as noted in the testimony. So I wish you well. And I'm going to continue the commitment. So it sounded like he considered family, but they weren't there at this time or at that time of the hearing.
Yeah, they didn't make an appearance at the hearings, but obviously the testimony from the doctor, she knew there was family. One last thing I'd like to suggest is the reliance of the court on the social worker's report seems wrong to me. We don't have, she's not a doctor, she's not a lawyer. For her to be giving the opinions that he should still be continued to be treated, or making judgments that have no supporting documents to it, I think it is incorrect. She needed to have put in, on this date, on that date, this happened, or we heard this, something to support it, just rather than just based on the social worker's opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose. Respondent, we're ready for you when you are.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christy Horman. I'm representing the respondent here in this matter, which is Steele County. Obviously, as counsel has stated here, the issue is whether or not there's enough evidence in the record to support the findings that were issued, and then whether or not those findings are, in fact, sufficient under the statute. Obviously, as the court's aware, the statute we're dealing with here is 253B.12 subdivision 4. Counsel's focus tends to be on the harm or the dangerousness, I think is actually the phrase that's used over and over. And I think that's misplaced here because this isn't a mentally ill and dangerous commitment. This isn't a sexually dangerous person commitment. This is a mental illness commitment. And under the statute, when the court's determining whether or not an individual continues to be mentally ill, what needs to be looked at are two different things, and that's further down in subdivision 4. And that's whether or not the patient is likely, which is also a source of contention here.
That likely, term isn't defined by this statute, right?
Correct, it
or
is not.
Left with the ordinary English definition of likely.
Correct, yes. That would be the respondent's position on that matter, yes. And that so that he's likely to attempt to physically harm self or others or to fail to provide necessary personal food, clothing, shelter, or medical care unless the commitment is continued. So here what we have and what I would argue from the respondent's perspective is, in based on the judge's findings, the district court's findings, is that this is an issue really of failing to provide the appropriate food and medical care, and that's contained within the judge's findings when he talks about the appellant not taking his medication, stating he's not going to take his medications if he's not under commitment. And there's testimony that historically, Mr. Valentine, or the appellant, decompensates when he's not taking his medication. He's been civilly committed 5 times prior. He himself acknowledges that the time frame as to what that span is a little bit in contention by him and the doctor, but what we do have in the record is he has been previously committed 5 times. So
there was no appeal of the initial commitment in this case.
Correct. There was not. So what we have is the judge stating that based on that, the prior commitments and the fact that he's appellant himself has stated to the doctor that he won't take his medications and the decompensation, that he does pose a harm to himself, that he may go back to where we started in this case, to being catatonic, not eating, thus not providing the appropriate food for himself. He then kind of adds in addition to that, the statements about the appellant making the threats towards the physicians and his parents historically. Counsel objected to that, finding when the court was making that finding, and the court still went with that and said that it was in the record and it was reliable, and that that was part of his decision here as well, is that there is a concern in that respect. And I would also point out that in in the matter of Gonzalez, which is at 456 Northwest 2nd 724, in that case, the court found that a person's behavior that makes him vulnerable to being assaulted or harmed if he's not doing well psychologically could be that basis for the likelihood of harm to himself or others. And in this case, based on the facts that we have, and the district court judge referring back to the original petition and findings that Mr. Valentine was engaging in conversations within chat rooms where individuals were encouraging him to kill himself, he was calling the CIA, reporting things. Those are the types of delusional, paranoid thoughts that could cause someone on the receiving end of those statements to react in a way to put Mr. Valentine in harm himself. So that also bolsters those findings. If he's aggressive, Dr. Rambo, I believe, also testified that his tone was a concern for her, and the way that he would interact with individuals, that could invoke a response from someone to act out or assault Mr. Valentine himself. So I think that also is a basis for the court's findings here, supports the court's findings here as well. So based on the record and the order that was issued, the court did make specific findings based on actions or statements of appellant here as to the basis for his findings, which is an argument that counsel asserted in her brief, that they weren't specific instances of conduct. And here there were those findings that there are delusional beliefs. There are statements that he's not going to take his medication. He declines to work with the treatment program and continue to work through that. So there are direct circumstances and instances of conduct that the court did rely on here as well. The judge's oral pronouncement of the findings runs from page 58 to 67 in the transcript. The court is very thorough in discussing what he considered, why he considered that, and the decisions that he did make in the respondent's view of that record here. So all of the findings, whether they were contained in the oral pronouncement or the written, I think both can be used to support those findings here. And they're based on specific actions or statements of the appellant. And therefore, combined with appellant's own statements at the hearing, which still demonstrated, I think, some disjointed, tangential, maybe paranoid thoughts as well, the court could rely on that in making its decision too. Just to touch a little bit, because there was discussion in the briefs on the definition of likely, counsel relies on the Ince case here, and the respondent would disagree with applying that analysis here. The proposition that the definition of likely here should be highly likely isn't applicable. There is no definition, as the court pointed out here today, within this statute or within any other case law. Therefore, we are left with just the standard English meaning of likely, and that would be what's appropriate to apply here in this case. And I think that in that Ince case, they went on to say that to make that finding of highly likely, you need to go to the multi-factor dangerousness prediction, which is used in a sexually dangerous person commitment, which is not what we have here. And I think that it would be improper to apply that standard here, because that's a hardier standard than what's required under the statutes for just a mentally ill commitment. These two types of commitments are considerably different. There's two separate statutory chapters that deal with them. Punishment, if you will, that will come from it is considerably different as well. A sexually dangerous person commitment is an indeterminate commitment. Here, under a mentally ill commitment, we're looking at 18 months unless a recommitment petition is filed, but then that requires court review again. So there's more court involvement in reviewing it here under this statute. So the respondent's position is that that reliance on the definition of likely from the Ince case is inappropriate here because the two types of cases aren't analogous. They're factually just different. In referring to the argument on the less restrictive alternatives, which is also a focus here, I will agree that the court order is very bare bones on that. I can't disagree with that. However, the King case that I cited in my brief, I believe, addresses that issue and doesn't necessarily render the commitment that this court should remand it or dismiss it. I think there could be a remand, but I don't think the court has to do that either for additional findings under that King case. In that case, the order doesn't make specific written findings, including the reasons for why the commitment was the least restrictive alternative. However, the court did make those specific oral findings on the record in that case. And in that case, the court found that oral support for the finding was sufficient to demonstrate that the court had considered the alternatives. Here in our case, we do have the court discussing what the alternatives were very briefly. I think really what was presented to him was either home or to stay at the hospital or continue the commitment. And the court specifically stated that even a step-down program wasn't appropriate given Mr. Valentine's or appellant's inability or unwillingness to take his medications if he wasn't under a commitment. So I think that the court did consider alternatives even outside of just home by using the phrase a step-down program. There are various different levels, obviously, as the court's aware, that could be considered. But I think those oral findings support the written finding, and based on that King case, there isn't a basis to reverse or dismiss the commitment altogether. And as I stated before, I would argue that there isn't even really a need to remand for additional findings based on that oral pronouncement that the district court made. In conclusion, it's the respondent's position that there is enough evidence to support the findings. There is enough to overcome the clear and convincing standard here that the appellant was, in fact, still mentally ill, that involuntary commitment was necessary, and there were no less restrictive alternatives based on the record that was provided to the district court and then to support those findings, and that those findings that were made are sufficient when combined with the oral pronouncement that was made as well. And therefore, I would ask that this court affirm the district court's findings of the need for the continued commitment of appellant. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Just briefly, the Linehan case, which is obviously 1, 2, 3, 4, been around for some time, and whether the definition of likely using historical reference into legislation is followed or not, one thing that we do know is that the original statutes were all included in the same provision. It wasn't until, 2012, 2014, that the sexual deviant statute was taken and separate apart. So the two descriptions follow using likely as a definition in that statute. You haven't ever, that I've seen, applied Linehan in that terms to the initial commitment. Counsel's correct. Inch was a sexual assault, a mentally ill commitment. And I don't know that there's anything that would prevent you from doing it, but I don't know that you need to make the necessary step. The language itself likely tends to seem, just by using the regular dictionary, more likely to occur rather than a less likely, which they would have used if they meant that.
Right. Likely means something well beyond possible or concern or could happen.
That's correct. That's correct, John. I think just the normal usage of it. I note that counsel discussed in the King case the finding. The information was in the trial that the only place he could be was a security hospital. The state hospital wouldn't work. And that was what the Court of Appeals said. Well, we'll say that was adequate to support the finding. We don't have that here. Thank you. Did you have a question before I sat down, or you're just moving?
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to counsel for the argument today. We appreciate it very much. The matter is now submitted to us for our decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. So that concludes the fourth matter on our oral argument calendar today. The fifth oral case will be heard by ITV. Now, I want to mention to the students before you leave, we understand if you do leave. Thank you very much for attending argument today. I just want to, again, extend that warm welcome. If you did want to have a brief conversation with us, we're going to take a recess. We'd be happy to do that if you have time to remain in the courtroom. I completely understand if you have something to move on to. So just for the record, I'll note that we are now in recess while the ITV is being set up. We'll have a brief conversation with the students.
All right.
We'll just stay here.
Yeah, I think we can just stay here.
Sit down.
Do you have time to join us? It's total.
All rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is back in session. The Honorable Judge.